Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Should a baker have the right to refuse to make a wedding cake for a gay couple? Just one of the questions before the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll hear about that case and several others this hour with our legal experts. Todd Pettis is with us in the Iowa City studio. He's the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation, a law professor at the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd, great to have you back in the program.
Thanks very much, Ben. I'm glad to be here.
Of course, the reason for the invite, the U.S. Supreme Court has started its latest session a couple weeks back. Mark Kendi is with us as well in our Des Moines studio, professor of law at Drake, and James Madison Chair in Constitutional Law and director of the Drake Constitutional Law Center. Mark, so good to have you back again as well.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And we're going to go through about a half dozen, seven or eight, maybe as many as that, the cases that we have time for this hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, ask question, any questions about how the high court works or perhaps the specific cases that we'll be talking about this hour, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. I wonder if I could start off before we get to an actual case before the high court, Mark and Todd. I'd like to have you comment on some news from this weekend pertaining to Iowa. The Justice Department dispatching an experienced federal hate crimes lawyer to our state here in Iowa to help prosecute a man charged with murdering a transgender high school student last year. Reading in the New York Times a little about this case, the basic, individual named Kendari Johnson, a 16-year-old in Burlington, shot to death in March of last year, March of 2016. Family and friends telling local newspapers that he was gay, but identified both as male and female and occasionally went by a different name, Kendisi. So I'd like to have your reactions to this when our attorney general sends a hate crimes lawyer to Iowa to help prosecute a man charged with murdering this individual. What does that tell you, Todd Pettis?
Well, it's highly unusual. I don't have the exact numbers, but this is not a common occurrence. Reportedly, it's because the federal government is itself contemplating bringing possible charges against the same accused man, the man accused of the killing. The federal government is thinking about bringing federal hate crime charges against him, and this is a way for the federal government to get an up-close look at the case. So that may be an explanation in whole or in part. And of course, it comes against the backdrop of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' other actions, specifically with respect to gays, lesbians, and transgender. He has pulled back the move that the Obama administration had made to give people, kids in schools, the freedom to use the restrooms of their choice. And under the Trump administration, there's been a move back to using the bathroom that corresponds to your sex upon birth. The Trump administration also looking at Title VII and employment discrimination law, which currently bars sex discrimination. The Trump administration and Attorney General Sessions have taken the position that that does not protect people from discrimination based, for example, on being transgender. And so I think that the actions here, they're newsworthy both because they're rare, but also because they come against that backdrop of other actions with respect to the same portion of the population.
Mm-hmm. Mark, do you see this also in newsworthy in the sense that it seems to be out of tune with the Attorney General under this administration rolling back legal protections for transgender individuals, for example?
It's a bit surprising, but it's also a bit hopeful. We know that the Trump administration, as Todd has already indicated, is going to be repealing some of the protections that the Obama administration put in place. But this is certainly not the best step in terms of it would be better to have a more group-oriented approach in terms of protecting transgender people. But it is a step in the right direction. And as someone who watches the news carefully, I am inclined to think that any step in the right direction is at least one good thing, but more could be done. Mm.
Let's go to our first case currently before the U.S. Supreme Court in its latest session. Mark, we'll stay with you if you could outline this for us. I see Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg suggesting this case may be the most important case of this term. Earlier this month, I believe it was that the Supreme Court heard the oral arguments and Gill versus Whitford, so-called partisan gerrymandering case out of Wisconsin. So tell us about it.
So, you know, we have the perception, or many people have the perception, that there's some democratic dysfunction in this country right now that's quite serious. And one of the issues that may be contributing to that is a disparity that sometimes exists. And Wisconsin has a particularly large disparity. And the disparity is between how many votes Republicans and Democrats get and then how many seats Republicans and Democrats get in the state legislature. And the Republicans have been in control of the government there for a while. And even though their votes don't justify it, the percentage of the number of Republicans that have been put in the state legislature because of the redistricting approach that has been taken and controlled by Republicans in that state basically is far in excess of what it should be in terms of the number of votes they got from the populace. And this is occurring in other states as well, and it creates a problem for our democracy.
So what has changed here? In sort of researching this, I understand that computer technology has helped us help parties become better, the parties in power become better at cutting up districts. Is that what this is also partially about? It's not that partisan gerrymandering has been deemed illegal.
Very much. Partisan gerrymandering, actually the court has, in a sense, withheld decision about whether it's something that can be held illegal. But in terms of what's going on here, there's sort of two terms that have been used. Cracking and packing are the terms of art. Packing is where Republicans put a huge number of Democrats in a district, and vice versa. You could have, you know, Democrats doing this in other states. And if you put a huge number of Democrats in a district, they're going to win, but a lot of their votes will be what are called wasted votes, in that they're unnecessary to win. And then cracking is when you put them in different places so that they can't win and that their votes therefore become meaningless because those districts have safe numbers of Republicans. So what's going on is computer technology, and in this case I'm talking about the plaintiff's use of technology, they've put into effect some technology that they call an efficiency gap exists in Wisconsin, anywhere from 10% to 12% in terms of what should be the number of Democrats in the legislature compared to Republicans based on, in part, the voting that occurs there. So the technology is being used both by the people who are doing the districting, but in this case, it's being used by the plaintiffs to argue that we now have manageable criteria for judging whether or not gerrymandering is occurring that we didn't have before potentially, and now the court should be able to decide these cases, because before the court was afraid to get into this because it wasn't sure what criteria it should use.
Mm-hmm. Is it clear what criteria the court may find most attractive, a clear-cut line and get rid of some of this grayness?
It's not clear which one the court will use. The one that's gotten the most attention is called an efficiency gap. I think I've mentioned that before. It seems to indicate a 10 to 12% gap in Wisconsin. The theorists behind this believe that a 7% gap is a regular figure which allows incumbents to basically guarantee a continuation of their superiority in this area. So a 10 to 12 is extremely high, way above 7%, and that's why the plaintiffs think they have a case, and they have a case that has these statistical criteria that support it.
Mm-hmm. We should probably mention here that in compared to Wisconsin and most other states, Iowa is an outlier here in terms of redistricting, isn't it?
Yes, Iowa is famous and often celebrated for its redistricting commission, and the commission is essentially supposed to be nonpartisan. And it is nonpartisan, and it has been rather effective in avoiding this kind of disparity and in avoiding litigation in most cases. And you know, just the other day, I was reading an article in of all places, a Massachusetts a newspaper, about how great the Iowa system is and that it should be the model for the country.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think that racial gerrymandering is illegal, right? That's been deemed by the courts to be unlawful, Mark.
That's right.
Okay. So when we take what is the difference in the court's eyes between racial gerrymandering and partisan gerrymandering? Why is there a difference seen there?
Well, race is a suspect class for one thing, but in addition to that, suspect class meaning it's a protected group under the Equal Protection Clause. But in addition to that, gerrymandering is always going to be partisan. And I don't mean that in the sense of, gerrymandering is always going to be something in terms of the way lines are drawn is always going to have a political element. And the court knows
that. You will never entirely eliminate it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they will never entirely eliminate it. And that's why several justices have said it's a political question that the court cannot get itself into.
Mm-hmm. Todd Pettis, jump in here.
Well, I think one of the toughest things for the justice, even those justices who are troubled by partisan gerrymandering, one of the tough things here is trying to figure out exactly what the standard should be. As Mark says, the social science, those who've done research, good research, one would be willing to say, about how Wisconsin compares to other states. You know, when you're trying to interpret the Constitution, you know, to say the Constitution will permit, you know, a 7% efficiency gap or a 6 but not an 8 or a 9, anytime you start picking particular percentages or something like that, I think the justices get very leery. And so, and of course, social science, like so much of science, it can change and convictions can change. And so for the Supreme Court to really tether itself tightly to a recently developed theory, only to find that in 5 years or 10 or 15 years, it's not thought to be quite the best theory, but the Supreme Court has nevertheless said that they can perceive it somehow in the text of the Constitution. So I think one of the big challenges for the court here is to try to find ways to articulate Wisconsin's sins, if you will, at a level of generality that lends itself to constitutional interpretation and can be flexible over time, but yet is also clear enough for those who are drawing the maps. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, those states that don't have commissions like Iowa, they're entitled to know how much partisanship can we get away with without triggering judicial review. So they're entitled to some clarity about what they can do and what they can't do. And so I think the court's caught in a real tension here between trying to interpret the Constitution, general standards, but also putting these legislators on notice about what's permissible.
This case on gerrymandering, the Wisconsin case, was heard in the first week of October. Reading some analysis about it, it seems that Justice Kennedy, as he often has been in the past, it would be a swing vote here. As Justice Kennedy goes, so goes this case. Do you see it that way, Mark?
I think that's probably right. He was the concurrence in another case where the court essentially had a plurality in favor of saying we're not going to get involved. But in his concurrence, he essentially hinted that, you know, extreme situations might be different and the court should be involved. From reading the tea leaves of the oral argument, which is always dangerous, it does seem that he may have a willingness to look at this as that extreme case. And that might solve one of the issues that Todd did a nice job of mentioning, of course, which is if you have an extreme case and you rule you have an extreme case, then it may be possible for the court to dodge some of the details and some of the specifics and make a generalized ruling that this is too extreme, but we don't have to decide yet exactly what the standard is.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned at the outset, to finish up here, Justice Ginsburg suggested it might be one of the most important cases of this term, which begs the question, what are the two political futures this country is facing depending on the High Court's decision here? I guess there is a decision one way or another, but also a decision perhaps not to decide.
Well, just from the perspective of how much of this is going on, I mean, the statistics I saw said that about 38 states have this efficiency gap, and there's litigation going on in several of those states. And, you know, overall in 2012, apparently, Democrats had 1.4 million more votes nationally than Republicans, but Republicans had far more of a presence in state legislators. So I don't want to make this sound like it's pro-Democrat because the principle would apply the other way as well. But it is possible that it could have a beneficial effect, I think probably most concretely immediately, for the Democratic Party.
Mark Kendi is with us of the University Drake Law University, where he's the James Madison Chair in Constitutional Law. Todd Pettis with us of the University of Iowa College of Law, talking about some of the most significant cases before our U.S. Supreme Court. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A case, Todd, for you to explain to us, one that has garnered a lot of press attention, triggered by a Colorado baker's refusal to make a wedding cake for a gay couple to celebrate their marriage. Now, the baker declined on religious grounds. Tell us a little bit about this case.
Yeah, he declined on religious grounds and free speech grounds. The case name is Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And the events happened back in July 2012. Of course, in June 2015, in a case called Obergefell, the Supreme Court held that states can't withhold gay marriage marriages for gay couples. And so gay marriage now happens across the country. But we weren't there yet when these events took place. And so this is July 2012. A couple walks into a bakery in a Denver suburb, two men, Charlie and David, I'll just call them by their first names, to keep things simple. They walk in and ask, say that they want a cake. Now, Masterpiece Cake Shop is not just an ordinary cake shop, at least by the proprietor's explanation. You can come in and just order a cake off the shelf, one that he's already made, but what he specializes in, he really thinks of himself as an artist, as a sculptor, and he says that you can buy an off-the-rack cake if you like, but I can custom design one for you. And that's a really special thing. And I'm speaking here as him. So, you know, I'll talk to you. I'll get a sense of you as a couple, what's important to you, your kind of vision of the future and so forth. And then I'll create a cake that's kind of my artistic response to you as a couple. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's part of his business. Well, as soon as these two gentlemen say that what they're looking for is a wedding cake to celebrate the wedding that they're going to be having, over on in the Atlantic region, because Colorado doesn't permit them yet, but they want to come back home to Colorado and have a reception. The baker says, I'm not going to do your cake. I have a religious objection to same-sex marriage. And so they started a legal proceeding, and the Colorado Civil Rights Commission got involved. Now, Colorado has what's called a public accommodation law. Iowa has one, too. I assume every state has one. And what these public accommodation laws in Iowa and Colorado and elsewhere say is that if you go into business, there are certain grounds on which you cannot refuse to serve somebody or to sell your product to somebody. And so race, for example, color, national origin, religion, sexuality, increasingly in many states, sexual orientation. Well, he's declining to make a cake for them because of their sexual orientation. So they say, well, that's a violation of Colorado's public accommodation law. And he says, I have a free speech right and a free exercise of religion right not to essentially speak in support of your religion. So kind of from the legal point of view, one thing that you have to understand first is it is possible for a cake to be speech in the same way that paintings, regular sculpture, the kind of sculpture that endures from year to year. In order to get protection under the First Amendment, we don't have to be talking about just literal words that are spoken or written. They include things that fall under the heading of the visual arts. So he says, those are my cakes, okay? And this is my art, and it's how I make a living as an artist is putting these together. And so what you're really doing here when you tell me that I have to do this, you're forcing me to speak. All right, and you're forcing, which is a First Amendment problem, he says, and you're forcing me to speak in violation of my religion, because when I speak through one of my cakes, I'm really helping the couple celebrate their wedding, but I don't want to celebrate this wedding because it's a same-sex marriage, and my religion teaches against that. Okay, so those are the legal grounds for his claims.
Mm-hmm. How much does that have to do with him as an artist, a cake artist? If you could imagine on one end of the spectrum, let's imagine a portrait painter put in the same position, or on the other end of the spectrum, someone saying making donuts for a wedding, or something that we have a hard time thinking of as artistry, for instance.
Well, he is making that front and center in his claim. When you read his brief, it's funny you asked that. I just want to read to you the first two or three sentences of his brief. So, you know, right, the first thing the justices are going to read when they hear from the baker, here's what he says. His name is Jack Phillips. His brief says, Jack Phillips's love for art and design began at an early age. long before television shows like Cake Boss and Ace of Cakes, I guess those are shows, Phillips carefully chose Masterpiece's name. It would be not just a bakery, but an art gallery of cakes. That's how he begins his argument. And so for him, and he puts his freedom of speech argument before the freedom of religion argument in the brief, signaling that perhaps he thinks he's got a better shot with that one. It's all about the art and the fact that this is Jack Phillips speaking when he creates these things. And his claim, we talk about kneeling for the national anthem, this whole notion of compelled speech and, you know, the government can't force me to speak. That line of doctrine goes back to flag salute cases in the 1940s. Jehovah's Witnesses school children refusing to salute the flag, and the Supreme Court held that school districts could not kick these kids out of school for failing to salute the flag. And so from those cases, we do get this general principle that the government can't make you say something that you don't want to say.
Do we have any indications? Has this case been heard?
No, it's going to be argued soon. I think it's being argued on December 5th. December 5th is when we'll hear the arguments.
Mm-hmm. What's at stake here?
Well, depending on what the court says, quite a lot, because, you know, he can talk about being an artist as a baker. There are, of course, a lot of people who sell things, either goods or services, that they might argue have some artistic or expressive dimension.
So I could make pancakes and claim the same thing.
You could. Cake or dresses, suits. For the party, the florist, and then you get outside the realm of weddings. There are all kinds of things. You know, you're going to run a bed and breakfast, and you say, hey, I'm going to set up the room in a particular way. This is my expression, and it's going to be kind of my response to you as a couple when you come. Right. And so if the court, which I'm skeptical it will do because it would be such a dramatic thing to do, but if the court were to write an opinion that broadly authorizes this kind of thing, that would really, I think, quite fundamentally change society. And because of that, I'm skeptical that the court will, in fact, write a broad opinion. But potentially, that's what's at stake.
Okay. We'll be back in just a minute with more from Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, Mark Kendi of Drake University, where he's director of the Drake Constitutional Law Center. We're talking about some of the most significant cases currently before the U.S. Supreme Court. Some of them, as you've heard, have already been heard. Of course, we don't know the decision yet. Some of them to be heard in the coming weeks. When we come back, we're going to turn to Mark to talk about a case that involves cell phones and how much information belongs to you or may be accessible to others that is on your cell phone. Also, we'll talk about a case that could deal a severe blow to public employee unions. This is the issue of whether public sector workers have a First Amendment right to refuse to pay union dues. That's when we come back, those and other cases. Todd Pettis, Mark Kendi, our legal experts today, picking apart some of the most significant cases that are shaping our society and may shape your life. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Mark Kendi with us of the Drake Law Center, where he's the director of the Drake Constitutional Law Center. He's also the James Madison Chair in Constitutional Law at Drake. Todd Pettis with us, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. We like to do several times a year, picking apart, in this case, the U.S. Supreme Court session, the most significant cases, and also not only going through the stories behind these cases, but looking at how these decisions may shape our society, depending on what the High Court decides, and may shape your life. Let's get back to it. Mark, cell phones are part of this next case, and the degree to which we have protected information on our cell phones?
So, yeah, it's a case about a series of armed robberies that was occurring, I think, in Michigan, and basically the police utilized cell phone technology by the towers that exist to be able to sort of locate where some of the potential criminals were. And by doing that, the issue arises as to whether, in some sense, they violate the privacy rights, because even bad people or criminals have privacy rights. And so that's really the question, is the use of this, the access to these towers. And what happened was they did not have a warrant, but they used a statute that did allow them to be able to access these towers. And the argument that's being made in the Supreme Court is that they needed to have a warrant to be able to access this information, even if it's with a third party, because it's still private.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the central question before the court is?
The central question before the court is really, do they need to have a warrant in order to be able to engage in this kind of inquiry into materials that belong to this one person? But the way cell phones work, obviously, it would bounce off of a tower. And if they're going through the tower, is that really a violation of the privacy right of the individual? And, you know, there's some sort of conflicting precedent, which always exists with most Supreme Court cases. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to sort through where this falls in the precedent. Is this in the privacy area, or is this in the area of exposed to the public, third party? Everyone knows it's public. Everyone knows when they go outside, most of what they do is not private, and that therefore there should not be a warrant requirement here.
Mm-hmm. What are the ramifications of the court's decision here?
You know, they're very interesting. On the one hand, you could say they're narrow in the sense that, you know, this is a case about what law enforcement does and looking for criminals, and most of us think that's a good thing. On the other hand, it's also potentially broad. The court has held already that it is something that requires a warrant to look into the actual cell phone contents of a person, typically, when you're arresting them. The court has held that putting a GPS on a car as part of a criminal investigation is something that's going to require a warrant. Here, the question that I, you know, really think about is, what is the significance of this in terms of the metadata and the other kinds of data that is collected all the time, we know, by different government agencies? Now, these agencies operate under very different statutes, often have very different justifications, such as national security, et cetera. But I think if the court were to go the route, for example, Justice Sotomayor seems to suggest, Justice Sotomayor in an earlier case has said, you know, normally if it goes to a third party, it's not private. But with this new technology, we have to have it. People can't really voluntarily operate without it, whether for work or personally. If they have to have it, then they should have a privacy interest in it. And so we'll see if the court goes in that direction. But so far, there doesn't seem to be a majority leaning Sotomayor's way on that.
Mm-hmm. In this case, Sotomayor, a liberal, seen as a liberal justice, does this break down, this particular case break down in terms of liberal versus conservative, so to speak, on the court?
I think there's a little bit of a breakdown that way. But as I said, I'm not so sure even some of the liberals are with Justice Sotomayor on this one. But she did give a very eloquent piece of writing in one of her opinions, talking about how, you know, as I mentioned earlier, in this new age with this new technology, our concept of privacy has to change. And if you use a cell phone, obviously it has to, as a signal, go through a tower. And that does not mean that you've lost your privacy rights.
Todd Pettis, let's turn to you for the next case. This has to do with public sector unions and the fees that members are sometimes compelled to pay.
Yeah, exactly. And so just a couple of things about union law that you have to understand that are important to make sense of this case, and also just about how unions work in this country. Typically, when a given workplace unionizes, the selected union represents everybody in that workplace. Okay. And so whether you're a member of the union or not, most people decide to join the union, but not everyone decides to join the union. And what this case focuses on is those who decide not to join the union, what, if anything, can they be forced to pay to the union for the union's services as that workplace's collective bargaining agent? And the country divides roughly in half. About half the country, half the states are right-to-work states. Iowa is one of those, and the other half of the country is not right-to-work states.
Which means?
And what that means is, if it's a right-to-work state, it means that if your workplace unionizes, you don't have to join the union, nor do you have to pay them a dime if you don't want to.
Okay. But you get all the benefits.
But you get all the benefits.
Pay raises and so forth.
You get all the benefits. In fact, the union is obligated to represent you in good faith and look out for your rights just as vigorously as if you were, in fact, a union member. In non-right-to-work states, roughly the other half of the country, like Illinois, which is where this case comes out of, if your workplace unionizes and you don't want to join the union, you don't have to pay for their, quote, political activities. So the union is going to get behind a particular candidate in a given race or something. You don't have to make financial contributions for that. But you can be forced to make contributions to the union to pay, basically reimburse the union for the costs that they incur representing you in collective bargaining and administering this collective bargaining agreement that's ultimately negotiated. And if you pay attention to the news at all and union law, you know that the last, generation or so has not told a happy story for unions, even in Iowa, which is a right-to-work state, which already kind of tilts a bit against unions. And February of this year, the General Assembly enacted laws that made life even more difficult, I think it's fair to say, for unions and union organizers. Well, another problem that unions are facing is challenges to this in non-right-to-work states like Illinois, challenges to this the current state of the law, which says non-members can be forced to pay the union for their services. And so this case out of Illinois, a gentleman named Mark Janis, he's a child support specialist in their Department of Health and Family Services, I think it is, and he doesn't want to have to pay the union, and the Supreme Court has signaled in the last half dozen years or so several times there's a group of justices that has real questions about the Supreme Court case that's currently on the books that dates back to the 1970s that says that people like Mark Janis can in fact be forced to pay the unions if that's what state law permits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so Justice Alito has led the charge, and when Justice Scalia was alive, it's kind of the story starts with one opinion where, just as an aside, five justices, that's a majority of the court at that time, signal that they've got real questions about this 1970s era precedent, and they think maybe it's not constitutionally permissible to be able to force people to make these payments. Mm-hmm. And the argument is that employees like Mark Janis make is, you know, when my union goes and is negotiating for my wages, that's a political thing. That's a political subject. How much the government should have to pay for this service or that service, what kind of vacation time should we get? Those are all questions of basic public policy, and that infringes on my First Amendment rights to speak and associate just as much as telling me that I had to pay for some political candidate. And so my union can't force me to make contributions to a political candidate, my union shouldn't be able to force me to make contributions for taking positions at the bargaining table.
So obviously, decided one way, it could deal a severe blow to public service, public sector unions.
Yes, of course. And you know, the AFSCME union is that's the union that represents state, municipal, and county employees. That's a big, big union in Iowa. And so even though Iowa is not directly in this litigation, the health of the unions like AFSCME that do business here and do business in other states as well, the financial health is potentially at stake in a serious way in this case.
Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, Mark Kendi of Drake University's College of Law. We've got a few more minutes to take on a few more cases. Mark, introduce us to a case that's being heard before the high court that involves sports and gambling in the NCAA.
Yeah, this is a fascinating case. We have New Jersey basically involved in this particular case, and there's a federal law that essentially prohibits states that already have laws against sports gambling from changing that. And New Jersey basically had a law that prohibited sports betting and then repealed it. They were sued by other leagues, actually. It's one of the most unusual things is that leagues, such as the National Football League, the National Basketball League, can sue when a state does something like this, even if it's an issue that involves more than their league. And so there's really two main issues in this case. One is the federal government going too far in intruding into the state's power to be able to make decisions? Is that federal statute what's called commandeering the state and forcing it to do something it doesn't want to do? And the second issue is what's called an equal sovereignty issue, which is a very clever argument New Jersey's raised, saying, hey, you know, there are other states that are allowed to bet and have sports betting, so why can't we?
Okay. And has this case been heard yet?
I don't believe the oral argument yet has taken place in this particular case.
Ramifications for gamblers, for sure. Any other wider ramifications depending on the outcome here?
Well, indefinitely, if they rule in favor of the state, it is going to open the floodgates in terms of sports betting, I think, potentially. If they rule in favor of the federal law, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Todd Pettis, there is a case, Jessner versus an Arab bank, that involves terrorist bombings. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, factually, it's a tough case. Between 1995 and 2005, that's the relevant time period, lots of terrorist attacks in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. Many, many people killed, many people injured. And so those who were injured and the family members of those who were killed have brought a lawsuit. Now, these are not American citizens. But they have brought a lawsuit in the United States, and they're suing the Arab Bank, which is based in Jordan. And so we have people who are not American citizens suing a corporation, the Arab Bank, based in Jordan, that also not a United States citizen, but they're suing here in the United States because they perceive that American laws can be more favorable to a claim like this. And so kind of in the big picture, the question is, well, are federal courthouse doors open to lawsuits like this? People who aren't Americans suing other people who aren't Americans for things that didn't happen on United States soil, but they want to come here and litigate. Mm-hmm. And the statute that's at issue is called the Alien Tort Statute. It dates way back to the beginning of the country, back in 1789. And it's a statute that says, it's a short little statute, that says that federal courts are entitled to hear lawsuits brought by, quote, an alien for things that violate the law of nations, things like torture, terrorism that violate the law of nations, and it authorizes non-Americans to come use American courts. And we've had several cases over the last 10 or 15 years looking at this statute. The statute sat and really did nothing until the relatively recent past. People didn't pay any attention to it. The story for how this statute came into being, it's kind of a scholars argue about what really happened, but suppose evidently in the 1780s, a Frenchman assaults another Frenchman in the French diplomatic house, and the minister of France says, I'm going to leave unless you Americans provide some kind of legal remedy for this member of my diplomatic corps mm-hmm. that got assaulted. And so they enact a legislation like this that identifies circumstances when someone who isn't an American can sue. Some of your listeners, if they follow the court closely, might recognize a case named called Kiobel. Kiobel is a big case that was involving the same statute that came along just a few years ago, where people in Nigeria sued big oil companies, saying that the oil companies had helped the Nigerian government torture, kill, rape, commit just terrible atrocities against them for resisting oil drilling operations in that country. And that case went up to the United States Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court said in that case is, well, if you want to get in the federal courthouse doors, you have to show at least some connection to American soil or some connection to the United States. Well, here in this case, Jessner versus Arab Bank, which was argued just last week, the connection to the United States is that the Arab Bank is said to have taken donations abroad in other nations' currencies, paid that money to the families of suicide bombers and so forth and leaders of Hamas, but they paid them in dollars. And the way they paid them in dollars is electronically through little wire transfers is they routed these currency transactions through a New York branch of the Arab Bank. And so it doesn't involve human activity, but electronically it does bring the United States into play. And so a couple issues in front of the court. One, is that enough? Is that enough of a connection to the United States to authorize a lawsuit like this? And number two, does this old statute allow lawsuits against corporations, which Arab Bank is?
Mm. Interesting. Very involved as well as being yes. Interesting. Mark Kendi, let's go to you. Tell us about a case as we wind up our hour. McCoy, the title given to this one.
Just a fascinating case. A guy who's accused of murder basically is assigned a lawyer and tells his lawyer he is innocent, did not commit the murder, and wants to have a trial basically, or, you know, at least not plead guilty. And the lawyer insists, literally insists, that he plead guilty in order to hopefully avoid being convicted of first-degree murder and avoid potentially getting the death penalty. So you have this direct conflict. The family gets involved. They don't want the lawyer to say this. But nonetheless, the lawyer stands up in court and basically, along with even questioning, there was some questioning of his client, which is kind of bizarre, basically argues, you know, that I'm going to do this. I'm going to follow the strategy. It's in your best interest because we'll avoid the death penalty. Well, he didn't succeed. He didn't avoid that. And the case went up through the Louisiana court system. And they said, you know, the lawyer consulted with the client and the lawyer at some level gets to make the decision. It seems totally inconsistent with the more general principle that really the lawyer is the client's assistant. And given what was at stake, it seems in particular in this case, it's stunning to me that the trial judge didn't do something about this very early on, which would have easily solved the problem.
So is the high court's decision here clear to you, or probable?
I think it should be clear. They should, you know, clearly rule in favor of the client in this case. And it may be one of those rare cases that is clear. But there is some precedent. It does give some discretion to lawyers in cooperation with a client to strategize to plead guilty in certain cases. And that precedent could come back. But this just seems so extreme to me. I'd be distressed if the court doesn't rule in favor of this guy.
About 5 minutes left. A couple of quick questions that have to do with, well, I guess the court's general operation, how it's been in the news. Neil Gorsuch, Todd Pettis, this is his first full term as the newest Supreme Court justice. What do we know about him? What have we learned about him in his short time on the court?
Well, he did have just a short period of time last spring on the court, and his voting record is quite telling so far as it goes. I think it was 15, 16, 17 cases he was involved in, and some who study the court kind of break the justices down into different categories, conservative, liberal, and so forth, but they also track how often justices vote with or against one another. Okay. Now, Justice Thomas, Clarence Thomas, is widely regarded as perhaps the most conservative member of the court by many measures. Okay. Well, in 100% of last term's cases, Justice Gorsuch voted with Justice Thomas. There was not one single case where there was any daylight between them. The justice with whom Justice Gorsuch disagreed most commonly was Justice Sotomayor, who's the most liberal justice, okay? And so those cases, if that proves to be indicative of what's coming, Justice Gorsuch, the youngest member of the court at about 50 now, is going to be the most, or certainly one of the most conservative members of the court. And I don't know whether a dozen and a half cases is enough to start to make that prediction, but on the other hand, those numbers don't seem likely to be a fluke.
In the minute or two we have, Mark Kendi, please address the travel ban that was all the talk of several months ago. The Trump administration coming out with a travel ban, then revising that, and then the latest iteration of that was some guidelines. The court said it would take it, and then now that doesn't seem like it will happen, or it would be pointless at this point, right?
Well, they dismissed one of the cases, basically, and facts have changed in terms of this travel guideline. So there is a possibility this travel guideline is written in a way that's far more sophisticated, and therefore even some liberals have said it might pass muster, whereas there was a pretty large consensus among many that the other one was going to have a lot of problems. But this one's more subtle, so they did learn something from the flack that they got.
Last time we talked together, Todd, on this program, we talked about it was a retirement watch. I suppose that's over for now that the session has started and no retirements were announced.
I think absent some health issue that we don't know about, I think it's over for this term. When you look at the justices' ages, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the oldest member of the court now. She's 84 years old. And just to put that in kind of a frame, the person who made it to the most advanced age while a member of the court was Oliver Wendell Holmes, who stepped down in 1932, and he was 90 when he stepped down. We've had a lot of justices, and so people's energy varies, their health varies and so forth. But Justice Ginsburg is getting quite old.
Barring something unforeseen, when is the next window for retirements you would be watching?
Well, they can retire at any time, of course, but I would think the midterm elections, because that'll tell us something about the composition of the Senate.
Right after the midterm election.
I think after the midterm or after toward the end of the term during which the midterm elections occur. So we'll have midterms next year. I don't think there are going to be any announcements right after. In fact, I'm sure there will be no announcements right after, because then it looks kind of nakedly political. But I think at the end of that term, if we're going to get any retirements before the end of Trump's administration, I think that's likely when we would see it.
We've run out of time. Thank you so much. Todd Pettis, the H. Blair and Joan B. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Mark Kendi, Professor of Law at Drake. He's the James Madison Chair in Constitutional Law. Mark and Todd, always a pleasure to have you in our studio to do some explaining of what, in this case, is going on in our high court in the country. Thank you, Mark and Todd.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Today with help from Helena Thompson. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.